It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's controversies over apes, yuppies, and salad spinners. We're talking with Dr. Franz Duval. He's one of the world's leading primatologists, and he's developed a controversial theory that monkeys are more like us than we think. And it shows up in how they deal with food. His book is The Ape and the Sushi Master. Gene and Michael Stern are eating John Wayne breakfasts in the California desert. Equipment guru Dory Greenspan examines the culture of the salad spinner. The outrageous Joe Queenan reads from his book Balsamic Dreams. And Matthew Goodman reports on the buns of Toronto. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide for nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. The time has come. My favorite herb is in its prime right this minute, so it's time to use it like there's no tomorrow and to freeze lots of it for winter. Okay, what is this paragon of lusciousness? It's basil, fresh basil. Picked in its prime. Now that means that the flowers on the top of the plant are barely in the bud stage. For my money, basil goes with just about everything. I mean, a little over the top perhaps, but that's my humble opinion. Now to understand how to use basil, it's good to know a few herb basics. When it comes to flavoring with herbs, they fall into a couple of categories. There are accent herbs and there are blending herbs. Accent herbs are the ones that, if you use too much, you could kill a dish. These are things like rosemary, thyme, bay, sage, mint, oregano, marjoram. Now, they're great to cook with. They highlight, they mellow dishes, they point out other flavors, but use them the way you would an exclamation point in writing. With great care. A little goes a long way. Then there's those blending herbs, the ones that if you go overboard, you're still safe. These tend to be the mediators of flavors. Usually their flavors are soft, and they sort of creep under the tastes of ingredients and lift them. The other thing about blending herbs is their flavors are appealing enough that if they do dominate a dish, they taste good. They're not strong and overpowering. Some blending herbs are things like chevrel, the leaves of fennel and dill, chives, coriander, and of course, the king of all blending herbs, basil. Now, I puree basil at the last minute and I add it to salads or soups. I pour that puree over sliced tomatoes and then toss that with pasta along with some cheese and olive oil and minced raw onion. Add some torn basil leaves to fruit sorbets. Just delicious. Make a custard flavored with fresh basil leaves and orange zest. Try this one. Pack a fish, any kind of fish, for grilling in crushed fresh basil leaves and lemon zest. Refrigerate that for a couple of hours and then grill it. That basil flavor permeating the fish just turns it to sheer heaven. Now, you've probably discovered there are all kinds of basils to grow. There's cinnamon basil and Thai basil and lemon basil and spicy globe basil. They go on and on. And if you garden, try them all. Each has something to bring to the party. And yes, you can plant basil in the middle of the summer in lots of parts of the country. Now, if you usually buy your fresh basil, get thee to a farmer's market. There's going to be a lot more herb for your money there, and usually the basil is fresh picked, and you can select prime fresh basil. Okay, so what do I mean by prime fresh basil? Well, it's simple. The younger the plant, the sweeter and the brighter the basil tastes. Older basil gets a bitter edge. Now, you can discreetly taste a bit of a leaf, and you'll see what I mean. So here's what to look for. Look for smaller leaves that don't seem thick or leathery. They should be from the top of the plant, and if there is any sign of basil flowers, they should just be tiny buds. Beware of cut-off stems. Now, this means that the youngest basil has already been harvested, and older leaves are now being sold. To store the basil, don't handle it too much because it bruises easily. Make sure it's dry. Keep it in an airtight plastic bag in the refrigerator. It can keep about 5 to 7 days. Oh, and don't wash it until you use it. It turns black if it's wet too long. So, this is what I do. I slice up my fresh basil. I go from the top to the bottom of the leaf. By the way, it stays greener that way. And then I sprinkle it over things like fresh cut cantaloupe with a little bit of lime juice. Makes a great dessert. So buy fresh basil, make sure it's young, and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed can get you started with their online pre-registry, online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Our guest today challenges some basic assumptions about who we are and how we're superior to animals. He's Franz Duval, one of the world's leading primate behavior specialists. His book is The Ape and the Sushi Master, and his theory is that primates have culture, similar to we humans. And much of it shows up in foodways. Our dominatrix of the test kitchen, Dory Greenspan, has been road testing salad spinners. Professional iconoclast Joe Queenan takes on yuppies as he reads from his book, Balsamic Dreams, a short and self-important history of the baby boomer generation. We look at blueberry buns in Toronto, and as we do every week in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Well, we've got Jane and Michael Stern ready to go. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, for people heading out to California, any recommendations?
Oh, we've got a good one. At the edge of the California desert, in the small town of Ramona, California, the Ramona Cafe is a taste of old California. It's a place that's been there since the 1920s, a kind of roadhouse, good eat stop for decades.
This is a place where literally John Wayne and Roy Rogers both used to stop regularly to eat breakfast when they were on their way to their mansions or their retreats or their homes in inland California near Palm Springs. There's something very, very traditionally old California about it, from the old cowboy decor when you walk in to the tables full of working men who are sitting having breakfast together. And breakfast is the big meal. Their specialty is something called the kitchen sink, which is an enormous ceramic skillet that comes with about a pound of fried sausages, plus bacon, ham, mushrooms, tomatoes, onions, pepper, garlic, sausage dotted gravy on the side, and a big homemade square biscuit to dip into it.
God forbid you should not have bread.
Yeah, so you should, yes. Right, you
this
should
is
go
a big,
hungry.
Big meal.
I mean, would John Wayne eat it at a place that served wimpy breakfast?
No, it's very satisfying food. And one of the interesting, I would guess you would call it a local treat, is they have all kinds of omelets. One of the great omelets they make is called a Gilroy omelet, which I'm sure, Lynn, you might suspect is loaded with garlic. I mean, this is a great way to start the day. It's ham, bacon, mushrooms, cheddar cheese, jack cheese, plus just gobs of fresh chopped garlic inside the omelet. It's very unusual. I never had so much garlic for breakfast, but it actually worked out well.
Well, you know, as we said, the place has been here since the 1920s, and I think it would be fair to say that culinarily they haven't quite gotten into the sort of new age California cuisine thing, and that's fine with me because one of my favorite things to eat there is under a special heading on the menu called Home Fry Special, which is just broad hills of great home fried potatoes that are topped with ham and bacon, taco meat, sausage, chilies, and peppers. I mean, it's really, this is not light California fare.
But it is balancing your carbs with protein.
There you go. It's the entire food pyramid on a plate.
You say it's old California. What does it look like?
It's just it's a great big pair of airy dining rooms. Very comfortable. It's been remodeled. It's not really a vintage California in terms of decor. It's just a big, comfortable kind of local hangout. People sit there and read the newspaper for hours, drink coffee, schmooze, hop table to table to greet their friends. It's a very comfortable kind of place to sit and eat. Also, one of the really nice things about it is there are a bunch of outdoor tables, so you can sit outside and watch cars as they head into the desert.
The place is actually decorated with a lot of old airplane memorabilia because the owner was kind of a airplane fanatic. So it's kind of a slightly eclectic decor of like 1920s Californian slash airplane slash old cowboy decor with murals of Ramona back in the 1920s painted on the wall. And Ramona is just kind of one of these very laid-back, sun-baked desert, high desert towns in California that when you drive through, it's the perfect place to kick back and just have a great, huge breakfast.
Followed, I must say, by a piece of chocolate peanut butter pie.
Oh, which is fantastic.
And then you take a nap.
And then you're the size of your car.
Yes.
You won't die in the desert. You'll have enough meat on your bones.
Thanks, you two.
Okay, Lynn, take care.
Bye-bye.
For a cowboy has to ride the range in yodelay, yodelay, boo. Listen to those doggies low and low, low. How I long to dream near a campfire's gleam and listen to the coyotes wail. I guess I'm just a cowboy and I'm bound to hit the trail. I guess I'm just a cowboy and I'm bound to hit the trail. Yodelay, 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 yodelay.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. You can hear them here every week, but you can get their road food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Greenspan writes award-winning cookbooks with some of the world's best chefs. She's contributed to every food magazine you can think of. But to me, Dory is the equipment queen. She loves to test drive cooking equipment. She reports on her findings every month in her Tools of the Trade column in Bon Appetit, and she comes by to tell us, too. Dory, welcome.
Hi there.
Dory, I'd like to talk about salad spinners.
Okay.
Because I have friends who really are challenged when it comes to taking them apart and cleaning them or just working them. So any research here?
I'm laughing because I'm thinking, your friends are spoiled. I don't know about you, but I remember my mother trying to dry salad pre-salad spinner days. My mom, the world's most unathletic woman, had this little basket thing. It would lay flat, a little mesh thing. She'd put the wet greens in there, pull up the handles, and it would become a basket. Then she would go out into the backyard. This explains why we never had salad in the winter. And would just whirl the thing around like a pitcher, but, you know, in wind-up motion. And, you know, it never occurred to me what people without backyards did. But, you know, when I think back about my mom whirling around that little basket, I think no matter what problems salad spinners have these days, I'm so grateful for them.
I guess that's true, but I think people do find some of them tricky to handle. And knowing how you love a challenge, you've got to have taken this on.
I have, actually, and it's true. Some salad spinners are better than others, and some look better than others. Some that look good don't work as well as some that don't. But essentially, there are three kinds of salad spinners. The kind with the crank top, the kind with the pull string.
The rope thing.
The rope thing.
Right.
And the kind that has a push top, the way a little kid's top does. I mean, essentially, they all work the same way. They're mostly plastic. There's a stainless steel salad spinner out there. I haven't seen it, but I know it's there. And basically, there's a plastic bowl. Within that, there's a mesh bowl, also made of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the top that has the set it in motion mechanism.
Right. Okay? And the bowl inside spins around and throws the water off, and it's caught by the big bowl.
Right. And so in the crank kinds, you keep turning this crank, and you've got to hug the bowl. And, you know, it depends on how intimate you want to be with your salad spinner. You might like this. You've got to hug the bowl with the non-crank hand. And then if you're patient, you just wait until the crank stops and the bowl stops, or you can just grab it, scream, whoa, and hope that it stops. And these spinners actually work pretty well. But I gave mine up. I now keep a mini crank spinner. Copco makes one that I use just for herbs and small things like that. And I've moved on to the pull cords and the push tops. Actually, the only push top I've seen is the one that OXO Good Grips makes. And it's a neat design. You push, 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 push. It spins, 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 spins. And then there's a little button that you press, and it actually stops it.
And that's it.
And that's it.
Is that one of your picks?
It's one of my picks, except it doesn't spin. I mean, I would like to put it on like super spin speed. It doesn't spin fast enough to dry the greens really, really well, really, really fast. And I'm a little impatient.
Mm-hmm.
But I like, it's a good looking one. It cleans easily. It's got a big bowl that you can use if you want for mixing the salad after you've not obviously not the open bowl,
mm-hmm.
but the outer plastic bowl is real big. And the one from Xylus, which is the one that has the pull cord, mm-hmm. I didn't really trust it. I was sure this cord was going to come off in my hand. But it's really very sturdy. Again, it works very well. And it has a little plastic top. So if you've washed your greens and want to store them just for a little while before you're serving, you can cover the top.
That's a great trick. Plus,
it's a good spinner.
Okay, so your order of preference, Dory, is pull cord, push, what we will call the top, and the crank, in that order.
Yeah, do you know anybody who just was listening to pull cord, push, and crank?
Yeah,
might wonder just what kind of person I am.
It's a good point. It sounds like an outboard motor, but we won't go there. Dory, thanks.
Thank you.
Dory Greenspan's column Tools of the Trade appears every month in Bon Appetit magazine. For more information on Dory's definitive work on salad spinners, go to our website. That's splendidtable.org. Coming up, The Ape and the Sushi Master. They're closer than you think. Balsamic Dreams with Joe Queenan and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here on The Splendid Table every week, online at Target.com. We've all seen a chimpanzee imitate human behavior, and we've comforted ourselves with the idea that this is imitation. Monkey see, monkey do. Scientists say the difference between the chimp and us is that we humans are the only creatures on Earth with culture. That is, we vary our behavior from group to group, and we learn by observing others. Well, primatologist Franz De Waal disagrees. He's one of the world's leading primate behavior experts, professor of primate behavior at Emory University, and director of the Living Links Center. His book, The Ape and the Sushi Master, Cultural Reflections of a Primatologist, piqued our interest. Professor De Waal, welcome.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, Franz, could you explain what the title means, The Ape and the Sushi Master?
Well, the title refers to my trip to the East, where I investigated Japanese primatology. And specifically, the sushi master story refers to the way an apprentice sushi master learns from the real master. And they do that by hanging out in the kitchen and not touching anything except for fetching ingredients and bowing to the clients and mopping the floor. And for 3 years long, they're watching the master make the sushi. And by the end of the 3 years, they're supposed to be able to make them themselves, without any errors. And so it's purely observational learning, no instruction, no formal formal teaching, no reward, no punishment. And we think that many primates learn, and many children actually, I suppose, human children, learn the same way. They see how things are done. No one tells them exactly why and how and gives them specific instructions, but they absorb all that information, and then at some point it comes out in their behavior. For example, there's chimpanzees in the forest that crack nuts with stones. It's a very complicated technique that if people try it, it takes them many years before they can do it without smashing their own fingers. And so it's a nut-cracking technique, and we know that the young chimps, for many years, they cannot do it, but they're watching their mom, and they're sitting next to it, and they're getting sometimes pieces of the nuts. And after a couple of years, they start doing it. And so we think that a lot of the transmission is the same way. It's by observational learning, but not necessarily teaching and instruction.
Well, are food rituals and food behavior, is that the easiest imitation that you've seen for most of these animals?
Well, food is very central in all of this. And so the first discovery of cultural transmission was on macaques in Japan. And the students.
Now, what is a macaque?
A macaque is a monkey.
Okay.
And they're fairly small. They're like twice the size of a cat or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they live on islands in Japan. And one of the island groups started washing sweet potatoes.
You mean they just found sweet potatoes and started to wash them?
No, this is actually humans handed out the potatoes. The potatoes were dirty.
Uh-huh.
And there was one young juvenile monkey, a female, who carried, after a couple of weeks, she started carrying these potatoes to water and cleaned them. And that by itself is not so interesting. What is interesting is that her peers and her mother very soon, a couple of weeks later, started doing exactly the same thing at the same spot. And then it spread to all the others, except for the adult males. The adult males basically never learned the habit. And so some people speculate that males are more resistant to cultural change than females are, maybe. Anyway, it spread.
One of those speculations that certainly we might agree with, but
yeah,
go ahead, please.
I know people do that in jest, of course, because we males, we are actually very innovative, as everyone knows. But anyway, this is what happened in these monkeys, and the potato washing became the classical example of how a habit developed by one individual may spread to a whole population. And now, of course, we know many more examples. We know whale song, we know bird song, we know many techniques and technologies in chimpanzees, many ways they use tools are being transmitted, and so now we have a much richer set of examples.
Is there, now that's how you define culture, that one thing, a habit is passed on.
Yeah, culture is defined, it's maybe strange because many people, when they hear the word culture, they think of going to the museum or listening to classical music, which is what I would call high culture. But eating hamburgers in a fast food restaurant is also culture. And so we have all sorts of cultural habits. And it is basically transmission of knowledge and behavior from one individual to another. As soon as that happens, we're speaking of cultural transmission. And if that's the definition of culture, it's found everywhere in the animal kingdom. And as a result, we can sometimes see groups of animals do things in very different ways. So, for example, if you show videotapes to me of chimpanzees in Africa, I can probably tell you where the video was taken, not based on the environment or the color of the chimps or whatever, but based on their behavior. In the same way that you can do with showing me an Italian family at the table or a Dutch family at the table, I can tell you the differences because I'm very used to European differences.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier on that it was significant that some of this thinking began in the East. What did you mean by that?
Well, in the West, there's a big hang-up about the difference between humans and animals. And this comes out of our religions in the sense that we have drawn this line. We have souls and animals have none. Animals are sort of machines. And even biologists depict animals still as a sort of gene machines. Now, in the East, the soul can travel from human to animal and from a monkey to God. And so the division between humans and animals is not nearly as sharp. And so the idea that animals could have things like culture that we use to set ourselves apart was not really alien to the Eastern mind. And this is why Imanishi, the founder of Japanese primatology, was the first to speculate and say, well, maybe they have culture. Why not? If we define culture such and such as transmission of knowledge and habits, they may have it.
Fascinating. Well, Professor Duval, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Franz Duval is the C.H. Candler Professor of Primate Behavior at Emory University and author of The Ape and the Sushi Master, Cultural Reflections of a Primatologist. Writer Joe Queenan doesn't timidly prod and poke at contemporary life. He hacks away with a machete. Joe is a professional iconoclast. He's contributing editor at GQ magazine and writes the Good Fences column in the New York Times. But for the moment, Joe's been pondering the history of yuppies and their contributions to the culinary world.
In seeking to analyze the failed promise of a generation that initially seemed to have so much going for it, but ultimately pulled a massive tank job, it is essential to pinpoint the pivotal moments in baby boomer history where things went awry. Let's start with balsamic vinegar. The pivotal date is September 24th, 1987. This is the day that ordinary guys started talking about balsamic vinegar. On September 24th, 1987, legend has it, a 30-something telemarketing executive named Peter McCabe drove out to the public dump 32 miles south of Wheeling, West Virginia, to shoot some rats with his high school buddies. The conversation that night was mostly guy talk, college football, work, babes. As the boys were saddling up to go home, one of them mentioned that he had four tickets to the Morgan State Marshall game that weekend. "All right," cheered three of the men. But Peter said he was not available. Unloading his shotgun, Peter politely explained that he was driving up to Carlisle, Pennsylvania that Saturday to buy some super premium balsamic vinegar. Although balsamic vinegar was available at a number of Italian grocery stores in the greater Wheeling area, the quality was not as high as Peter would have liked, leaving him quite unsatisfied with the crusty sturgeon with rosemary and balsamic vinegar he so loved to prepare on the weekends. When Peter told his friends that he could not go to the football game that weekend because he had to go shopping for balsamic vinegar, the amazing thing is not what the other three men did, but what they did not do. They did not immediately beat him senseless. This was the first time in American history that an average guy had escaped with his life after begging off a football game because he had to go shopping for the ingredients needed to make his renowned crusty sturgeon. Spice buffs and cultural anthropologists may contend that this arguably apocryphal incident is not, in fact, a watershed moment in the history of the baby boomers, that the real break with the past would arrive at least 5 years later, when ordinary men would start asking complete strangers on the subway where they usually purchased the basil they used in their pesto sauce. Others may single out 1997, the year in which a majority of heterosexual men were actually capable of visually distinguishing between vermicelli and spaghettini without massive amounts of coaching from their wives and girlfriends. But I disagree. It is my heartfelt belief that once 30-something baby boomer rat hunters felt comfortable enough to discuss their balsamic vinegar shopping expeditions with their fellow rodent predators, the face of America had changed forever. When young people ask today what baby boomers did with all that free time they had after Nixon was run out of office and the civil rights movement trickled away, or for that matter, what they did with all the time they didn't waste smoking, the answer is easy. They listened to every recording of Vivaldi's The Four Seasons they could get their hands on. They read a lot of books about southern France. They attended a lot of past life regression workshops, moved heaven and earth to empower their inner gods and goddesses, studied ancient Vedic breathing techniques, mastered the art of designing and applying henna-based tattoos, learned how to make candles, and massively, though not completely, reduced clutter. And they made one hell of a lot of salads.
Joe Queenan is author of Balsamic Dreams, a short but self-important history of the baby boomer generation. Matthew Goodman writes about Jewish culinary traditions for The Forward, but with a twist. He takes us down unexpected paths, like the Jewish origins of fish and chips in London, and the new wave of Bukharan Jewish restaurants here in America. So, Matthew, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, Matthew, what have you been working on?
Well, Lynn, if I were to ask you, what is the most beloved food of the Jewish community of Toronto, what would you say?
Well, I guess I'd say I don't have a clue, but I'd imagine something like the bagel or some sort of smoked fish. Or...
Well, I'll tell you, I had no clue either until pretty recently when I started asking people. And it turns out the answer is not the bagel. It's close to the bagel. It is the blueberry bun.
Oh, of course, that old Jewish... What are you talking about, a blueberry bun?
Who knew? Who knew? But blueberry buns are the most beloved food of the Jews of Toronto. The blueberry bun is to them what bagels are to the Jews of New York. It's, you know, you bring a dozen blueberry buns to your friends when you go over to brunch. You bring a bag of blueberry buns to your kids up at summer camp. You know, you stop and have a blueberry bun on your coffee break. It's really a daily fixture of the community there.
So what are they like? What are these blueberry buns?
It's probably most like a French brioche, but it's shaped sort of like a deflated football, if you can imagine that, sort of oval-shaped and
right.
flat on the bottom. And then it's filled with blueberries, but unlike our jelly donuts, it's not just a little glob of filling that's injected in. It's just packed with blueberries, because what they do is they actually roll out the dough,
yeah.
and then they pour lots and lots of blueberry filling on top, and then they very carefully fold over the dough on top, make a little seam, egg wash it, sprinkle sugar on it, and bake it, and it comes out absolutely wonderful. It's a great pastry.
All right, but now the big question, why in Toronto?
Well, exactly. That's one of the great mysteries of the blueberry bun is, you know, how did it get to Toronto and where did it originate? And nobody knows the answer to that for sure. One clue, though, may lie in the fact that, you know, many years ago in Toronto, the blueberry bun was known by the Yiddish name Stritzel or Stritzlich in the plural. And Stritzel is actually a fairly uncommon Yiddish word. It's not even listed in the standard Yiddish dictionary,
mm-hmm.
but it is listed in one of the smaller, more idiosyncratic dictionaries where it's defined as a currant cake. So my guess is that it probably was not so much a cake, but more of a sweetbread that was filled with currants, made in Eastern Europe. And then in the early 20th century, when there was that massive Jewish immigration out of Eastern Europe, and, you know, one of those immigrants was surely a baker who had made Stritzel and upon coming to Toronto discovered the wonderful blueberries that, of course, proliferate in that region and hit upon the idea of filling the Stritzel not with currants, but with blueberries. And, you know, thus a little bit of culinary history was made.
Can you give us some idea of where to go so if we're in Toronto, we can have some?
Sure. You know, of course, the question of where to get the best blueberry bun in Toronto is a subject of some contention among the locals. But the general consensus seems to be that The best blueberry buns come from a bakery called the Open Window Bakery. They've been making blueberry buns since 1957, and they use a recipe that was given to them by a Mrs. Kaplansky. That's how she's known, Mrs. Kaplansky. That's the other great mystery. What was her first name? Nobody even remembers anymore. She's Mrs. Kaplansky. And she was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. And who knows? She may have been that first baker who created the blueberry bun. Nobody knows for sure. But she had a bakery called the Health Bakery. And when she sold her shop, she gave the recipe to the Open Window. And that's the recipe that they use. And, you know, remarkably, they gave me a slightly modified version of their blueberry bun recipe. As far as I know, it's the first time the recipe has ever appeared outside of Toronto. But, you know, you can make them at home. And
are they,
you know,
close? Of course,
you know, they're not as elegant as the ones that they've been making in the Open Window for 50 years, you know. But it's fun, and they come out just great. You know, they're crusty and sweet. It's just a delightful pastry and well worth the effort.
So, Matthew, you going to share this recipe with us?
You can have it, you can put it on the website, and we'll all carry on Mrs. Kaplansky's tradition together, I suppose.
Hear, hear. Thanks a lot, Matthew.
Thank you, Lynn.
Matthew Goodman writes about Jewish food traditions for the Forward. You can get his recipe for Toronto blueberry buns on our website. That's splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We have Beth on the line. So, Beth, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have been saving old wine.
Oh, that's good.
That is turned to vinegar.
Oh.
To use in salad dressings and cooking and things like that, but it's not quite vinegar.
Right. Exactly.
What do I need to do?
Well, first of all, you need to essentially get what would be called in science, I think, a catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
What you have right now is sort of bad alcohol.
Yeah.
Not bad for you, but it's bad alcohol. And what you need is something that is going to convert the alcohol to acetic acid.
Right.
And that thing is often referred to as a mother.
Mm-hmm.
It's this substance that develops on the top of unpasteurized vinegar if it's left exposed to the air. It looks almost like white gelatin.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a little bit of that in the bottom of a crock or a bottle and you throw wine into that, mm-hmm. by gum, after about 5 or 6 weeks, you're going to get vinegar.
Okay.
So there's a couple of ways of getting it. First of all, you could go on the web and check out sources for mail ordering a mother.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There's something very amusing about that to me. The other thing that you could do is, it takes more time, but it's kind of fun,
mm-hmm.
is buy some vinegar that isn't pasteurized. And that's often the higher priced imported wine vinegars, maybe from France. And what you do is you leave the top open of the bottle and you look. And what I did once a long time ago, and I kept it going forever, was once I saw the mother form, you know, I poured out half the vinegar and then I just let it sit. And after several weeks, you could see this scum, thick, gelatinous thing.
Okay.
I just poured out most of the rest of the vinegar and I added my wine every day to it.
Okay.
And, you know, when it tasted like wine, I'd let it sit with the top open for a couple of weeks. When it tasted like wine, I'd pour that off and just keep adding more. I just kept using that one bottle.
Okay.
So go up on the web. One place to look, there's a guy named Lawrence the Vinegar Man.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if anybody's going to have a mother, it's going to be Lawrence.
Right.
But you can probably find it on other, you know, kind of gourmet grocery store, whatever, websites.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And by the way, you're going to end up with sensational vinegar. And it may be a little strong. You may want to dilute it with water. But you are going to have vinegar the likes of which, you know, you've probably not had. It's going to be delicious.
Okay, good.
Hey, enjoy it.
Thank you. Okay,
Beth.
Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for our food question of the week. Now, just remember, in going for the answer, think obscure. I love obscure. Okay, the question is, What's the herb you should never, never cut if you're in love? We're going to have that answer in a moment. And more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The lines are open for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. That number is 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to our food query of the week. The question was, what's the herb you never cut if you're in love? It's parsley. Now, if you believe British folklore, a lover cuts up parsley and disaster strikes the loved one. It gets worse. You should never transplant parsley or give it away, because if you do, your luck goes with it, or you could die. Now, all this parsley death and destruction business started with the Greeks. One of their homeboys, a hero, was killed in battle. Parsley sprouted up from his blood, and that branded it. It was the herb of death. Now, it takes a long time for parsley seeds to germinate, so some imaginative types with too much time on their hands started the rumor that parsley seeds had to go down to the devil and back 9 times before the plant sprouted. Their favorite saying was, "Parsley grows for the wicked, never the just." Well, the cooks couldn't stand these killjoys. Greek cooks used to use parsley all the time. Now, I did a takeoff on a Greek parsley mashed potato dish. You take cooked potatoes, you crush them with lots of garlic that you've braised in olive oil, and then you fold in some chopped parsley and scallions, and you sprinkle everything with lemon juice. By the way, there are two kinds of parsley. The flat leaf kind, which is used mostly in the Mediterranean, and to me it always tastes like a cross between a celery leaf, basil, and black pepper. The curly type, well, that's more subtle, maybe a little one-dimensional. So try the potatoes. The recipe's on our website, splendidtable.org. Just be sure to have someone who's not big on romantic attachments chop the parsley for you. Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Now, let's see, who has been waiting patiently? Ah, we have Pam on the line. Pam, what's happening?
I wanted to talk about olive oil. I've gone to ethnic grocery stores, like an Arabic grocery store, and they had something called pomace olive oil.
Right.
What is it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Pomace olive oil is the lowest grade of olive oil. And essentially what it is the crushed mass of olive that's left after you've pressed the olive oil. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it is treated with solvents, chemicals, mm-hmm. to extract more oil, and with heat to get all the oil you can out of that that's left. And then what they do is they mix it with a virgin olive oil, not an extra virgin, mm-hmm. but an oil that's higher in acid. It's called virgin olive oil. It's around 1.5 to 3% acid to make it taste okay. And that's what pomace oil is. And what you'll find in a lot of kitchens is that people use it for cooking. Now, the difference is, for instance, extra virgin, which you always hear about. Well, that's about as close to the olive as you can get, because extra virgin is olive juice.
Uh-huh.
Essentially, all it is you press the olive with no heat, no chemicals. It's as pure as it can be. So this is the other end of that spectrum.
Okay, thanks.
So if you want to save money, it, you know, if it tastes okay, all right, but do know you got some chemicals that maybe you're playing around and you have heat and whatever, okay?
All right, thanks a lot.
You are welcome. Okay, you can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we have Barbara calling. So, Barbara, what pressing thing is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I was hoping you could help solve a mystery here.
I love mysteries. What's the mystery?
Okay, well, I'm actually calling on behalf of my mother. She and a friend went to a restaurant in Connecticut about a year ago, and they had a dish made with purple rice.
Oh.
She said it was superb, and I wish I knew more about it. My mother's away on vacation, so I can't ask her the specifics, but she said it was wonderful. So she and her friend, who both happen to be gourmet cooks, you know, went out looking for purple rice, and actually we found some in a local gourmet restaurant, I'm sorry, a gourmet shop in New Jersey. And she tried to prepare it the way they said to prepare it at the restaurant, and it came out tasting something like cardboard. So I've been searching on the internet and other places looking for other ways to prepare purple rice and have come up with nothing, and I thought maybe you could help us.
Well, there's a tricky thing here. I've only run across red rice and black rice, and I'm wondering if your purple rice isn't a variant of the red variety.
Okay.
Do you know, because all of these, let me put it this way. Colored rices are fascinating because they come from a lot of different places, and each one is a different rice, and that means it cooks a little differently. And do you know what determines the color of a rice, whether it's purple or black or red? It's the bran on the outside of the rice. So essentially, it's like eating brown rice.
Okay.
You know, it's going to always cook a little longer. Do you know the origin of the rice you bought and the origin of the rice she ate?
No, although I know on the internet, I did find purple rice, and it was, I think, Thai.
Right, right. Okay. There's this family in California, the Lundberg family, who do all of these cool rices, and they work organically. And they do something called Wahani, which is a deep mahogany-colored rice, and they do a black Japonica. So if it's one of their rices, generally you cook it more or less the way you would brown rice. You know, about more or less like 2.5 cups of water to 1 cup of rice. And you cook it about 30 or 40 minutes until it's tender. You pull it off the heat, you keep it covered, and you leave it stand for about 30 minutes. Now, if it's Thai red rice or Thai purple rice, usually what you do there is it's 1 cup of rice to 1.5 cup of water. You see the proportion is so different.
Right.
And you cook it about 30 minutes. It should be tender, and then you let it stand 15 minutes. Oh, wait a minute. Something just occurred to me. Did you chill the rice before you ate it?
I don't think she did, no.
Sometimes people make it. There is evidently a rice, and I think it comes from Thailand, that you always just leave it at room temperature. If you chill it, it hardens up. There's something in the cell, in the structure. There's something in the rice. I would try that 1 cup to 1.5 cup water, 30 minutes or until it's just tender, and then take it off the heat, but keep it covered and let it stand 15 minutes.
Right. Okay.
And if that doesn't work, then I would say think more liquid and longer cooking. Because it sounds like what you had was undercooked rice.
Okay. All right.
There's so, you know, I have a book for you.
Okay.
I'm serious. Anybody who loves to cook would kill for this book.
Mm-hmm.
It came out last year. It's called The Seduction of Rice. And there is so much information. All of this kind of information is in there with great recipes, wonderful information about the origins of rice,
great,
the history. It's by a couple, and I can never remember the husband's name, but the wife is Naomi Dugweed. It also was named the Book of the Year by the James Beard Foundation.
Great. Okay.
It's called The Seduction of Rice.
Uh-huh.
It's about rice all over the world.
Wonderful.
Use it because it's going to be a good guide for you. It also is going to tell you where to find the rice.
Great.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Okay, love your show.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
A woman of taste and discretion. It's rice is really a real crapshoot because what I've learned is these rices can come from so many different countries and they may look similar, but they are completely different strains of rice and they're going to handle completely differently. Some need soaking. Some need longer cooking. There's this one rice that if you refrigerate it, it turns into something like stone. This book, The Seduction of Rice, is really a dynamite reference. And it's just fun to read, and it's a beautiful book, beautiful photography. Okay, let's see. Who's up? Oh, by the way, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. And we have John on the line. So, John, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
I have neither taste nor discretion, but I love your show anyway.
John, I love that. Now, what makes you say that?
Well, I'll tell you, the best way I can answer that is to say that when I listen to your show, the chances that I'm eating either a peanut butter sandwich or Kraft macaroni and cheese is really high. And I listen because the fact that you have someone like me in your audience, I hope you're glad for that, because I don't belong here, but I love your show anyway.
Oh, but yes, you do. Remember, it's a show for people who love to eat. And well, we're not saying what.
Right, right.
I have a confession to make. Peanut butter and jelly, I'm really a cream cheese and jelly person. I was raised on that. But peanut butter and jelly has never been something that I would turn my nose up at. And I have this trick for peanut butter and jelly. Well, you use crunchy peanut butter, but then you crush salted peanuts before you put the jelly on the bread.
Ooh.
So you get a real crunch. I mean, this is sort of the gastronomic miracle of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And you have to do it on squishy white bread. None of this whole grain.
I do most things on squishy white bread, Lynn. So.
This is, well, hey, there's a reason for this. But did you have a question by any
I really
chance?
Do, yeah. I'm calling to ask your opinion or thoughts on what I know as slow roasting or low temperature roasting. And I'm calling specifically about meat. I used to have a large toaster oven that, in addition to bake and broil, had a setting called slow cook. And came with a book and suggested that you could use it as the roasting equivalent of a crock pot. And I used to do this, I think, almost always with a pork loin.
Uh-huh.
And you could put something that would ordinarily take an hour, and you would let it cook for 4.5 or 5 hours. And I really liked how it came out, and I loved the fact that you had a basically ignore it main course.
Yeah.
And you could fuss over the other things and know that the main course didn't need a lot of your attention. And then a couple of weeks ago, I heard an interview with a writer from, I think, the Los Angeles Times, who has written a book called The Secret Life of the French Fry.
Yeah, yeah, it's Russ Parsons. And
right.
Dynamite guy.
This book sounds like it deals a lot with, I guess, what you call cooking chemistry. And he talks about the effect, you know, what happens at different temperatures, especially with meat. And that if you don't get to a certain temperature, the fat in the meat never really gets involved. And so my question is, do you ever recommend this method of cooking, which is, you know, a long time at a low temperature for any meat? And if so, are there any dangers in it in terms of, you know, now that we live in an age, you know, is there life after dinner because of what can kill you?
Yeah.
I wonder if it's ever something that we should do.
I'll tell you, for a guy who doesn't cook and lives on macaroni and cheese from Kraft, these are great questions.
Well, I listen. I just
yeah.
Don't know how to
cook. You've raised, this is a great question. Here's the problem. Up to a certain point, the slower you cook proteins, including meat, the more tender they will be, the less cellular breakdown there will be, and you know, releasing of moisture. But as Russ says in, I think it's How to Read a French Fry is the name of the book,
that
if it's too low, the fat never breaks down. You never get that succulence in that juice. And if it's too low for too long a period of time, you're creating an incubator for potentially dangerous bacteria to grow.
Right.
So the rule of thumb generally is, if it's much below 300 degrees, I'm talking about the oven temperature,
right,
best not.
Okay.
Now, if you have a piece of meat that is 10 inches thick and you do it at 300 degrees, you have a serious problem, because by the time any heat penetrates the center of the meat, it could be spoiled.
Right.
If you have a typical pork loin roast, a center loin roast, which is maybe 4 inches or 3.5 inches thick.
Right.
That 300 degrees is going to be fine, and you're going to get a juicy, tasty result. One of the guides you may need, it's a nice thing to have anyway for a lot of other reasons, is an instant reading thermometer. You can find them in any kitchenware store.
Right.
And you stick it in, and that will tell you internal temperature. But yeah, slow roasting is a great idea, but leaving a pork loin in a very low oven for 4 hours would make me very nervous.
Right.
2 hours, not too bad.
Right.
And of course, to make this even more complicated, if you look at how traditional Southern barbecue is done,
yes.
You know, whole chunks of pork butt, which is the shoulder, mm-hmm. People are cooking at relatively low temperatures, and people have been eating it for years. We have no idea how many people die from it, but the reality is it's been around for a long time.
Right, they're not here to talk about it.
I know. Well, yeah, it's an interesting aspect, but we don't know if it's really unsafe. But I'm telling you what science tells us.
Right.
Keep it around 300 degrees, and if you have any doubt, bring it up to 325.
Okay. All right.
And it's tricky stuff, but if you remember that, you'll be okay.
Okay. And I think your listeners should know, I've always assumed that you pre-talked your questions with your callers, because I would think nobody can possibly know as much as this woman knows right off the top of her head. But people should know that you don't do that, that this is unrehearsed, and I'm more impressed than ever.
Oh, John, thank you.
Well, listen, the peanut butter's calling, so.
Yeah, and remember, try the crushed peanuts.
I will.
Okay, John.
Thanks, Lynn.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Guys, I've got a couple of suggestions. You know, summer cooking. This is the good stuff. First of all, I have what's called a quasi-herb garden. It means I haven't really done much work in it in a couple of years. So I have the marjoram plant that took over the world. This plant now has tendrils that are showing up 6 yards away on the other side of the block. My entire garden is this marjoram. But what's interesting is when the flowers bud, they are so delicate. And I want you to think about this. If you go to the farmer's market or you grow your own stuff, look for flowers on the herbs and try cooking with them. I mean, for instance, just take a chicken breast, throw some white wine on it, a little olive oil, and crush some basil flowers over it or thyme flowers over it and grill it and then serve it with some more of the fresh flowers. Great way to season. Great way to season. The other thing is think about playing around with some new spices with summer grilling. I've got this combination I'm in love with. I think this combination came to me because I like Moroccan food. But I've been mixing ground cumin, ground coriander, and really good Hungarian paprika. And garlic. Always garlic. Rub that on pork or even lamb and then grill it slow. See what you think. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with an observation from Garrison Keillor. He said, people have tried and they have tried, but sex is not better than sweet corn. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place you can register for Target's own kitchen essentials, hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you've heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. As always, thanks to Rob Hibzinski for his musical insights. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.